wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning and happy Labor Day. And welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, the show that takes its name from Karl Marx's figure for the revolution, working away underground, changing the terrain of everyday life from below. We come to you every Monday morning at 9 here on KBOO Portland and streaming everywhere on KBOO.fm. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. Today on the Old Mole Variety Hour, we talk about work, of course, and in particular, both the work of labor organizing and the work of climate defense. First, Joe Clement talks with Marianne Garneau about strikes and the politics of worker power. They consider how strikes have been tamed in the last 100 years by labor law and what that has meant for their usefulness in winning gains for workers. If strikes are still useful, what makes them powerful? Marianne is founding editor of the site organizing.work and an organizer with the New York City Industrial Workers of the World. Then, Bill Resnick talks with Emma Ray Lyerly of the Rainforest Action Network about the fires burning in the planet's last remaining rainforests in Brazil, Indonesia, and the Congo. Governments and agribusiness corporations like Cargill and financial interests like BlackRock and J.P. Morgan Chase are responsible for destroying the lungs of the world, as well as local and indigenous communities that depend on these forests for their sustenance and livelihoods. When the forests are gone, the monocrop plantations replacing them become the only options for work. Finally today, we hear from Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, The Left and the Law. They discuss the work of climate activists preparing for direct action this month and their need to know their rights under the First Amendment. Jan and Mike consider what these rights are, as well as how fascists also enlist the First Amendment in defense of their hate campaigns. The Left and the Law team talk about free speech and free assembly rights guaranteed by the First Amendment and legal challenges in mobilizing for direct action on climate justice. You'll be able to find the show online at our page on the KBOO website. Later in the week, we'll have posted individual segments, bonus material, and more information and links on the Old Mole Variety Hour page at kboo.fm. You can also find links there to subscribe to our show, so you can have the show delivered to your favorite podcast listening service. That page also has links so you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or contact us with questions, comments, suggestions, or interest in participating. We turn now to Joe Clement's conversation with Marianne Garneau about strikes and the politics of worker power.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Happy Labor Day. Today, my guest is Marianne Garneau, a founding editor of organizing.work, an online platform of articles and podcast conversations about workplace campaign struggles from workers' own perspectives. Additionally, they do investigative reporting, commentary, and even movie reviews on the challenges workers and unions face today. Marianne is also an organizer with the New York City Industrial Workers of the World and has been on the show before to talk about solidarity unionism. Thanks for coming on the show, Marianne.
Thanks for inviting me.
So, as many people may know, Labor Day, this Labor Day, is a holiday that was founded over 100 years ago, and it was a response by the U.S. Congress to both mounting calls from the labor movement for a national labor holiday, but also specifically the aftermath of breaking the Pullman railway strike in 1894, which was a bloody affair that involved the army and 30 killed workers. And so Congress passed a bill that made Labor Day a national holiday on a day in September. This was years after the establishment of Labor Day festivals in multiple states, and after the 1886 Haymarket Affair, which led to a commemorative May Day in 1890, famously founding what we call International Workers' Day, what in many countries is Labor Day, May 1st. Labor Day today, though, is grounded in this famous strike, a great example of the class warfare that defines this country's history, that defines the capitalist economy in history again and again. And for related reasons, the strike has a very romantic history in the left, and it is not without its uses, but Marianne and I are specifically going to talk about the evolution of strike tactics in history and what we may be wanting to do differently today. Marianne, what is different about the way workers face the question of withholding their labor today versus over 100 years ago?
Well, I think you presented what strikes looked like 100 years ago pretty accurately. They were bloody. The army would be called in. Private Pinkerton guards would be called in. Workers would stream out of the factories, sometimes chain the doors shut, sometimes occupy the factories. And they were met with a tremendous amount of physical resistance and physical violence from bosses helped by the state. The other thing that would happen is that bosses sometimes would lock workers out. I mean, violently clash with workers in conflict that they initiated, where they would lock the factory doors shut because they were trying to teach workers a lesson or starve them out or kill organizing or whatever. And so there was a very kind of bloody, pitched, overt battle and conflict between labor and capital or bosses, factory owners, 100 years ago. And that eventually culminated in the creation of the labor law that we have today. So the first thing was the Labor Relations Act of 1935, which is sometimes called the Wagner Act, which basically said that, okay, if employees want to form a union, they have the right to form a union, and employers have to recognize that union, and employers have to negotiate with workers in that framework. But what that labor law did is it really just tamed that system of conflict. So it came up with kind of bureaucratic, regimented processes whereby labor and business would sit down across the table from each other and talk to each other and hammer out negotiations, because it was trying to tamp down all that massive unrest in work sites. And the name of the act itself is something like, you know, an act to prevent the disruptions of interstate commerce. I forget the exact title off the top of my head, but it was explicitly in the title that it was about trying to keep production flowing and trying to keep the economy going and not have all of this unrest and disruption. And so if you understand that history, you understand why labor law today is meant to really kind of constrain worker activity. And that explains why strikes today are a very, very different beast than strikes 100 years ago, which were these bloody overt conflicts. Strikes today are very constrained. They're very tamed. Employers are entitled to hire replacement workers, and there's nothing that workers can really do about that. They can't physically clash with them. They can't occupy the factory or the store anymore. The employer and the union are supposed to sit down and quietly negotiate at a table far away from the workplace. You know, the workers have the right to strike, but again, they don't have the right to prevent business. So strikes today, they're still a very powerful tool on the part of the working class, but they look very different than they did 100 years ago for specific reasons, and those reasons have to do with the way that government has sort of intervened to change labor law.
Today, you know, we have had the teacher strike waves in the so-called red states and even in the so-called blue states more recently. And in a lot of cases, these strike waves were led by workers who were taking a different approach to the idea of them being in control of the union. And not in all cases were the unions really against what the workers wanted, but in some cases the official unions were very ambivalent or quiet or basically saying, our hands are at the steering wheel here. And I'm wondering whether that potential, you know, is with the working class in general, and if through that we can still think of strikes as potentially, you know, game-changing tactics in the struggle for a better world.
They're definitely game-changing tactics, and it's still the best weapon that workers have. If you take this sort of long view of history, you can see how when government or capital, you know, business owners, whatever, don't make enough compromises, then you get unrest. You know, you get massive unrest. And what has happened with the labor relations system, especially in relation to public sector workers often, because they don't have the same right to strike or they don't have the same rights to surrounding bargaining is if you mistreat people enough, they eventually rise up. And in the West Virginia case, you know, the unions are very, very constrained in what they can do because of laws, because of facing financial penalties or other penalties. And so the unions kept saying to the workers, don't worry, we're on it. We're throwing money behind getting a particular, you know, Democratic figure elected, or we're using our powers to reach out to and lobby members of government, you know. And that wasn't really accomplishing anything because those are, of course, very tame tactics. And so eventually those workers kind of just rose up. They were fed up with it. The strike momentum spread, and they eventually went on that massive strike, and they won gains from that, and that was very significant. And you can imagine that the next move that's going to take place, and I think there's already murmurs of this, is government is going to find a way to pass a law that says, like, okay, you can't do X, Y, Z. You know, whatever it was that enabled them to actually mobilize that, you can't do it anymore. So it's kind of this, like, cat and mouse game where labor rises up, a few concessions are made, and then laws are implemented to sort of prevent that striking again or prevent that formula from arising again. And, you know, in the U.S. for that matter, you've had, after the Labor Relations Act, there was the Taft-Hartley Act of 47 or 48, where unions were prevented from going on sympathy strikes or all the things that had become powerful tools in labor's toolkit were outlawed, so that, again, it tamed working class uprising and militancy and solidarity and that kind of thing. But, you know, again, if you take too much away from people, they start to do it kind of spontaneously. And sometimes the only people who are left in that position to uprise spontaneously are workers, because the unions themselves would just be, like, sued out of existence. The union officials would be fined. They'd be prosecuted. The union would be fined. So sometimes it's just left to workers.
Which is interesting, considering the fact that that vulnerability comes out of kind of accepting the legally or socially sanctioned roles in the economy that labor unions in their top brass represent. And before that, unions were illegal in a lot of places, either in the law or just in the fact that the bosses could legally retaliate against them. And in that prior period, there was a sense of more potential in the workers' movement.
Well, the other interesting thing, too, is that sometimes nowadays, especially, it's thought that the reason why unions are stagnant is because they just have bad leadership, right? So the leadership is bureaucratic. It's these guys who are kind of, you know, unimaginative politically, and maybe you know, they're bureaucrats. They don't have any vision. You know, they're holding us back. And you see that, for example, where the DSA recently voted on what they call a rank and file strategy, which basically means, like, we need to somehow infuse unions with socialist leadership. If it happens from below, so be it, whatever. You see it also in West Virginia, where there's a turn to a reform caucus strategy. So that's where you try to take over the union leadership with better leadership that has better vision, whatever. But the reality is that the way that unions become stodgy and bureaucratized and non-revolutionary is that they are constrained in these very legible ways by the law, and by the fact that business also, or government also, won't negotiate with too radical of a leadership. Like, there's all kinds of forces that are both formal and informal that tame union leadership until government or business has something that they want to negotiate with, right? And in fact, other labor unions will tame labor unions that start sticking their militant necks out too much, right? That you can like kind of ostracize them within the labor community, cut off their funding, raid them, you know, and so forth. So there's tremendous pressure on unions to behave in this tame way, and it's a misnomer to say that it's just because of unimaginative leadership and that we just need to replace, like, the handful of bureaucrats at top brass with people who have more radical politics.
What do you think needs changing, though?
I think what needs changing is that we need to really revive the ability of workers to organize from, you know, what I call the shop floor. That's kind of like an antiquated word, but from the bottom up, from the workplace. So whether it's teachers, or whether it's I organize with restaurant workers and with other performers and with, you know, service workers. Whatever the workplace happens to be, workers need to basically have the ability to talk to each other, identify each other, talk to each other and build what I would call a committee of workers. So meet with each other, talk about their issues, and then develop the ability to take action around those issues. You know, that is a kind of power that bosses, that is so much more effective against bosses. Workers collectively withholding their labor, that's the soul of the idea of a strike, basically, right? But rather than carrying that out through union bureaucracy and the legal methods that are available to unions, which, as we've talked about, are pretty stunted, that has to be carried out from the bottom up. And when you get that on a big enough scale, you get massive effects, like you saw in West Virginia, right, with teachers or elsewhere with teachers. So it's scalable, too. But it has to start ultimately with workers looking left and right and talking to each other about their working conditions and what they're going to do about it.
Well, that's all the time that we have for the on-air portion of my conversation today with Marianne Garneau, editor of Organizing.Work. If you tune into kboo.fm/oldmole when the show is posted, you'll see a bit more conversation about strikes and working class strategy. Thanks for coming on the show today, Marianne.
Thanks so much.
Listen, worker, I'm the boss. If you don't make me money, you're gonna get tossed. What I pay you is what you get, so take your mind off all of my profit. Listen, tenant, I don't agree. This ain't your home, it's my property. I will milk it for what it's worth and kick them out who can't keep up. Back off, landlord, don't bully me. Yes, tenant's got solidarity. Got a union that'll go on strike for every new goddamn rent hike. Fellow workers, hear me sing about the power to change everything. Without labor, without rent, all our bosses are impotent. When the day comes and we see our special power in the economy, we will seize the great machine and finally live, finally free.
That was the multi-talented Joe Clement giving us a musical close to the first part of his conversation with Marianne Garneau about the history and power of labor. You can find more of their conversation about worker organizing when we post the show on the Old Mole Variety Hour page at kboo.fm, home of KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, non-commercial, listener-sponsored, full-strength community radio for Portland, Oregon, the Pacific Northwest, and the world. I'm your host today, Fran Michel. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. Later on today's Old Mole, we'll hear from Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, The Left and the Law, about what the First Amendment means for those engaged in climate direct action. We turn now to Bill Resnick's interview with Emma Lyerly of the Rainforest Action Network about the massive forest fires burning in massive rainforests around the globe.
Hi, Emma Ray Lyerly. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Nice to talk to you again.
Emma Lyerly works for the Rainforest Action Network located in San Francisco. She's the media coordinator for forests. The Rainforest Action Network, the RAN, in its words, I quote, preserves forests, protects the climate, and upholds human rights. That by challenging corporate power and systemic injustice through frontline partnerships and strategic campaigns. That challenging corporate power and systematic injustice, those words excited me. The RAN is not one of those NGOs that are supported by major donors or big money. Anyway, this was a banner week for forest fires around the world. The 88,000 fires in the Amazon got the major headlines, but huge forests in Indonesia and Siberia are also now on fire. In Alaska, too, in areas that never burnt before, they were on fire recently. And fire season is just underway in the northern hemisphere. There's a lot more of them to come. Should this forest burning continue, rates of global warming will surely greatly rise, and global heating could go out of the possibility of control, warn many scientists. So, Emma Lyerly, let's discuss that threat that forest burning poses to planetary life.
Yeah, it's been a devastating week for sure. The news, you know, the Amazon has been burning for over 3 weeks now, but really the news hit this past week. And, you know, as you said, Indonesia, you know, the Arctic, yeah, it's really, the whole world is on fire, and it's devastating to watch. You know, wildfires are a natural occurrence. You know, for some forest ecosystems, fire is a really healthy thing and a really needed thing. And you could say that our forest management domestically has really disrupted the fire cycle to the detriment of our forests. But what we know is that in rainforests like the Amazon or the Indonesian rainforests, fire is a very rare thing, if ever. And certainly the way that these uncontrolled fires are burning is very far from natural. You know, these fires are being intentionally lit by people to clear land for more industrial development. There's nothing natural about it. There's nothing healthy for these forest ecosystems about it. It's purely just a devastation for more corporate profit.
Yeah. Well, the Amazon forest in particular is extremely important, as at least what I've read, it's a hypothesis, and tell me if it's right or not, is they store vast amounts of carbon that if burnt and going into the atmosphere, that goes in as carbon dioxide, and you get huge amounts of global warming. Well, the Amazon forest is this storehouse of carbon in the ground, littering it, in the trees, all of it. And secondly, the forests around the world were described as regulators of the climate. Is that the way we should see forests?
Definitely. You know, I think a lot of the talk around climate change has really left out the important role that forests have to play in regulating our global climate. So just as you said, you know, forests, particularly the last three major rainforests on the planet, which are the Amazon, the rainforests on the Indonesian islands, and also in the Congo Basin in Africa. These last three rainforests provide a huge amount of carbon regulation for our planet, for the entire planet. There's been a fact going around, you know, that the Amazon produces 20% of our oxygen. That's in dispute. It's probably not that much. But, you know, what these rainforests do is not only do they produce the local rain that sustains their own living, but they sequester carbon out of the atmosphere and they safely store it underground. You know, that is a carbon sequestration system that we don't have to spend, you know, billions of dollars trying to geoengineer. There's nothing that we need to do to that system to make it just perfectly operational and perfectly functional and regulating our global climate for generations to come if we were to leave it alone. That's sadly not what we're doing. And the thing about rainforests as well is, you know, most rainforests, you know, are old growth, especially the Amazon and the Indonesian rainforest, and that means that they've developed these really thick layers of peat underground, you know, these peatland areas that are just years and years and years and years of the decomposed leaf litter.
These peat bogs. And they're also
unimaginable.
Right. Yeah. Peat bogs are also in the Arctic and, in fact, in temperate climates, right? This enormous amount of woody matter that's sort of stored in these wet places and never really escapes.
Exactly. It's safely held underground. There's more carbon stored underground in these rainforests than the trees actually, you know, sequester themselves. And so when that peat is lit on fire, you know, there's a reason that communities around the world have used peat to fuel their home fires. It burns very, very well. It burns very long. And so when these peatlands are lit on fire, they burn forever. It will burn underground until the monsoon rains come, and it's terrible.
Yes. Even when the monsoon rains come, that puts them out temporarily, but then they start burning again when it becomes dry, is my understanding. And furthermore, when it's used for agriculture and palm oil in particular, they, in order to deal with the monsoon rains, they dig trenches to get rid of the water, right? And that then exposes the entire peat bog to drying out and continuing to burn. And then, of course, the palm oil gets made into candy. What a fate for our, and a metaphor for how humans are destroying things.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, just to break it down, so the main drivers of deforestation, rainforest deforestation globally, are palm oil, as you said, you know, beef and cattle ranching, soy production largely to feed those cattle, pulp and paper, and then timber as well. And these commodities are being pushed into rainforests in different areas at different rates. So in the Amazon right now, largely we're seeing this expansion being done for cattle, you know, more land to graze cattle on, and then for soy production.
And in soy Indonesia, production, Trump's tariffs are now creating a huge demand for soy from Brazil, apparently. And well, it's not just Brazil, because a lot of these farms are owned internationally, right, by agribusiness. They're just paying vandals to start burning down the forest near them and so that they can create more soybeans.
Exactly. And then in Indonesia, it's similar, but the commodity is largely palm oil or pulp and paper use. But the cycle for all of these commodities is very much the same. You know, it is corrupt local government and corporations working in tandem to go in and do a land grab. You know, generally they are stealing and displacing the local communities, the indigenous people that have lived on that land for generations. So they steal the land. And then in Indonesia, you're right, they log it for timber, they build canals to drain the water out of the peatlands, and then, you know, they get the land ready to plant these monocrops, just these, you know, these plantations of palm oil trees that literally go for miles and miles and miles. If you stand in the middle of one of these palm oil plantations, it feels endless. And they really do swallow whole villages inside of them. And, you know, that then becomes the only option for work. It totally erases any sort of local livelihood that was there before. You know, it obviously has already killed the forest that the communities have used to subsist on, to grow their own crops, to hunt for their food. And that's true of the Amazon as well. You know, it's really just these, you know, these corporate interests push into these areas, they destroy the forest, they destroy the communities and the ways of life that have been there, and then they try to get the most, you know, the most yield out of this land for the most profit, the quickest. And the sad thing is, I mean, it's all very sad, but, you know, the ultimate devastation is that that means that that land becomes unusable fairly quickly. In Indonesia, if you drain a peatland, it settles, you know, it subsists. And it very quickly goes below sea level. So Indonesia is losing its land mass at an alarming rate. Indonesia is about to move its own capital city of Jakarta because the city of Jakarta is sinking. And it, you know, it makes this land unusable very quickly. And so then they have to expand into new territories. And that's true of Indonesia. That's true of the Amazon. And it's this, you know, never ending hunger for a quick profit, fueled, as we're seeing in Amazon in particular, by a government that spouts a very anti-environment, anti-indigenous rhetoric, you know, that basically gave the command to light the fires, to open the Amazon for business, as Bolsonaro said. And we're seeing the effects of that. You know, he made good on that promise. A year later, the Amazon is in flames. And really, it is U.S. companies that are fueling that demand. So, you know, there are the financiers that have pumped money into these industries. There are the global commodity traders. Cargill, you know, is a homegrown American company that is hugely involved in this. And then there are the retail brands that buy up these end products and sort of look the other way in terms of where their supply chain is coming from and where they're, you know, what kind of impacts it's having on the ground.
Yeah, this is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Emma Ray Lyerly of the Rainforest Action Network, whose sole goal and passion is saving the rainforests. They're also working with other organizations that are trying to save the temperate forests and even the Arctic forests, which is they're all burning. Emma Ray Lyerly, let's first just comment. When they take over, the villagers, of course, went in areas that are being destroyed. Sometimes, often, they organize. And, of course, the people who are running these operations from, as you pointed out, from Zurich and Wall Street and many other places, they don't like the opposition. And at some point, the local thugs kill a lot of people, like in Brazil, many, many, many indigenous people, as well as non-tribal people who've lived in those areas and who have become environmentalists, small farmers, fight back.
Exactly. Local and indigenous communities are some of the best defenders for these forests. They've defended these forests for generations. The last IPCC report, you know, really confirmed what indigenous people have known for years, which is that most of the world's biodiversity survives on lands held by indigenous people. Strong, organized local communities and indigenous communities are the best defense against corporate expansion onto their land. And they defend their land and they defend the world's forests, sometimes at the cost of their lives. And we're seeing that dramatically increase as more violence and, you know, more pressure is being rained down on these communities to get them to yield. And, you know, there is, sadly, many cases of violent assassination of forest defenders and tribal leaders, you know, in the Amazon, in Indonesia, really all across the world.
Again, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole talking to Anna May Lyerly of Rainforest Action Network that is, in fact, supporting all of those frontline people. Let's talk about your efforts towards forcing companies to stop using the products of land theft and murder all over the world. These companies know where they're getting their supplies from. There's pressure on them to find other sources of whatever they have to use. How much success are you having with those various industries, like the candy industry?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to say how much success we're having. Obviously, corporations, you know, don't want to give up business as usual without a fight, and we're seeing that effect in the Amazon. I think that it's easy as consumers in the West, and it, you know, I hate to just lump us all into consumers, but that is largely what we do, is consume these products. And it's really attractive to say, okay, you know, I won't buy palm oil anymore. I'll read every label of everything I buy and I won't buy palm oil. You know, and maybe it is ultimately a great thing to try to eat less meat or, you know, not use leather. The individual lifestyle changes are important and they're great, I think, on a personal or community level. But ultimately what we see is that it's not necessarily these commodities that is the problem, but it is the way that they are produced. So if we were to pressure these companies to move away from palm oil and they just moved into canola, let's say, and they produced canola in the exact same way that they are producing palm oil right now, it would have the exact same disastrous effects. So what RAN is calling for and what other organizations call for as well is really a shifting of the entire industry. It is a moving of the entire business model, and it is really putting the responsibility back onto these major retailers who are the largest consumers in the world. You know, they are the ones that have multi-million dollar, billion dollar contracts. They have the actual buying power to shift these industries, to apply their leverage against the entire supply chain and change how business is done. And so that is what we campaign for, largely on the candy makers, as you said, or snack food companies. Cargill is sort of a homegrown name, and also the financiers. You know, BlackRock is the largest holding company in the world, JP Morgan Chase, one of the biggest banks in the world. And these are the companies that are really fueling these businesses and this expansion into the Amazon and into the rainforests of Indonesia, they have the buying power to change it. And so that's where our campaigning goes.
Yeah, I wonder how successful that will be unless a political revolution, maybe not an economic revolution, but a political revolution would happen in sort of Bernie Sanders' term. Unless the states around the world, the important ones, put huge amount of pressure on these predatory and murderous apparatuses, not much is going to change. Emma Ray Lyerly, you have the last word after my little sermonette.
Yeah, I think my last word would just be, you know, the situation is dire. And, you know, people often ask me, you know, or say that I must have a lot of hope to do the work that I do. And I, you know, have some hope, but mostly I have a lot of anger. And I think that it is time, maybe as you alluded to, that everyone gets really angry and demands systems to change, because it is truly unlivable for everybody on our planet for business as usual to continue. I'd really encourage your listeners to get involved. There's going to be an Amazon Day of Action on September 5th. Folks can learn more about that and get connected to groups maybe in their area that are taking part in that. And yeah, check out Rainforest Action Network. Check out Amazon Watch. They're doing amazing work in the Amazon. And get involved, you know, in your own local communities and internationally as well.
Emma Ray Lyerly, thanks so much for talking to us. And the climate strike is also coming up. It could really be a busy and wonderful month for
exactly.
climate struggle. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
It's been great. Thanks, Bill.
Work, 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 work. You see me happy, work, 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 work. You see me do me there, 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 there. And some better work, 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 work. When you walk a line, 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 line. I'm in the cafe, my tat, 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 tat. Drive me a dessert. Time to have you lurking. You make a like, now you don't like it. You know I dealt with you the nicest. Nobody touched me in a righteous. Nobody text me in a crisis. I believed all of your dreams are duration. You took my heart, all my keys, and my patience. You took my heart, I'm asleep for decoration. You mistaken my love, I brought for you for foundation. All that I wanted from you was to give me something that I never had. Never seen something that you never been. Mm-hmm. But I wake up and nothing's wrong. Just get ready for work, 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 work. You see me happy, work, 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 work. You see me do me dirt, 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 dirt. And some of that work, 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 work.
That was Rihanna with Work. And before that, Bill Resnick talking with Emma Lyerly about the work of the Rainforest Action Network. I'm Fran Michelle. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. As Bill notes, September is a busy month for climate activists. September 20th starts a global climate strike called by the youth of the world. And as Emma Lyerly mentioned, September 5th is the Global Day of Action for the Amazon. The National Articulation of the Indigenous Peoples of Brazil has called for international solidarity in response to the fires and ever-increasing threats. Amazon Watch and Extinction Rebellion are leading a call for actions on September 5th at Brazilian embassies or consulates and at the offices of corporations profiting from Amazon destruction. Portland doesn't have a Brazilian consulate or embassy office, but our listeners elsewhere can check out actionnetwork.org to find out about events in their towns. Closer to home, there's climate action coming up later today. At noon, kayaktivists will be meeting at the Columbia River at Kelly Point Park in North Portland to continue the call to stop the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion and stop tar sands everywhere. The Trans Mountain expansion is a tar sands crude oil pipeline proposed to be built in Canada. Right now, pipe for the Trans Mountain expansion is sitting in the port of Vancouver, Washington, waiting to be transported by rail to Canada. And more is coming. If built, the Trans Mountain expansion would transport an additional 590,000 barrels of tar sands oil each day. It would continue to lock Canada and the Pacific Northwest region into a fossil fuel economy. It would be a violation of our atmosphere and climate and to Indigenous rights. You can find out more at 350PDX or from Portland Rising Tide or the Mosquito Fleet. Next, on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker have a Left and the Law segment about the rights to free speech and free assembly guaranteed by the First Amendment and legal challenges in mobilizing for direct action on climate justice.
Well, this is Labor Day, at least in the United States, and among the many undervalued and underappreciated forms of labor is the work of activism. And this summer, as Fran just noted and listed, activists are working to prepare for a week of climate actions, including those going on today. In trainings for direct action tactics, which often involve the potential for getting arrested, activists are often instructed in their rights under the First Amendment. I went to a training a week or two ago, and the trainer asked us what our understanding was of the First Amendment to raise our hands, and there were very few hands that went up, including, I confess, to my own hazy understanding of it. So, Mike, let's talk about the First Amendment. What are the rights included in the First Amendment? And then we'll get into their implications for activism.
All right, Jan, I think the First Amendment is at the core of what's good about this country. The first part of it says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. What that means is that there is no religion or no ideology so obviously true that we all have to bow down before it. And that the second part says, you cannot pass a law prohibiting the free exercise of religion. So there's everyone in this country is free to worship in whatever way they want or not worship in whatever way they want. Again, it's because there's an implicit contract here, an assumption that the truth is not glaringly obvious, and the best way for the truth to emerge is to let people continually explore and express themselves and let the rough and tumble of exchange of ideas and which ones surface is the best way to find out what's really going on. The next one is the freedom of speech. Closely related to that is freedom of the press. These mean that you can say whatever you want unless there's some sort of imminent danger. You can abstractly advocate for the overthrow of the government of the United States. But if you're saying to somebody in the heat of the moment, punch that person, shoot that person, that's banned because force and fraud that's immediately available is something that you cannot advocate for. But other than that, virtually any sort of speech in any sort of form is protected. Finally, the right of the people to peaceably assemble is guaranteed. That means you can gather, and so long as you're not threatening other people, you can gather in any size you want for any reason you want. It's primarily aimed at power, points of power, either corporations or the government. And you are allowed, finally, to petition the government for redress of grievances. These guarantees have basic assumptions about how society should be ordered and give guarantees that allow people to stretch themselves mentally to not have to feel like they've got to constantly look over their shoulder to know whether or not any sort of expression of ideas is going to bite them.
Like any abstract principle, the devil's in the details and how it gets applied, and that's why God made lawyers, right, in courts to decide these things. And around hate speech, there are continuum of positions within the left, both in terms of what constitutes hate speech and where the limits on the First Amendment guarantee of free speech, and then tactics to resist it. So we can, and I'd like to start with the first part of that, the first question. How might we think about the meaning of the term hate speech and the resistance and organized resistance to forms of oppressive language once you move from an era where assault was understood as physical assault to an era that recognizes language as itself injurious, assaultive, potentially traumatic to people?
Well, the First Amendment is very tough on hate speech. It basically is...
Tough in what sense?
It's tough in the sense that it's very repeatedly been held to be protected by the First Amendment. The way you will cope with hate speech is not by passing laws against it. The First Amendment sets aside the government in all sorts of contexts. The way you combat hate speech is with more speech, with more creative demonstrations, with more forms of expression. You don't combat hate speech by going to the legislature and lobbying for a law that then relies on the police to enforce it.
So one distinction you're making is in how you enlist the law or the police to subdue the other side. So let's talk about the recent Proud Boys fascist gathering in Portland and the counter anti-fascist protesters and the rally. I was there a few weeks ago, and there were a lot of debates in terms of how to counter this. So how would you frame that issue and the tactical, and I guess there's also political ethical issues as well as legal and tactical ones in terms of how you fight these fascist groups?
Well, to begin with, you are free to have those tactical discussions. In fact, that's the creative way to combat bad ideas. Like what happened here is, first, there was enough widespread opposition to the Proud Boys that the counter-demonstrators exceeded them greatly in numbers. So there was a greater mass, a greater physical expression. But more importantly, I think, there was the creative ways in which people resisted. There was tons of ridicule. White flower was opposed. People dressed up like bananas. They were expressions of ridicule that diminished the overall gravity of the white supremacist acting as if civilization is hanging in the balance unless our race is protected by shifting gears, shifting tones. They were minimized.
I'd like to add a caveat to that, because when I was down there, one part of the rhetorical strategy of resistance that seemed to get a lot of applause was, get out of the Rose City, this is our town, you know, like we're a city of love. And this drawing to some extent on the fact that they were outsiders from rural areas. And
that's
a very
provincial thing to say.
Well, and
do.
It's kind of, it can be very reactionary. You know, you don't belong in our town. And of course they are, and they don't represent all of rural communities. So there's, I think, this potential to rally people around a false sense of urban unity against rural, you know, these cowboys coming in, gunslingers coming into Portland to disrupt our peaceful town. I mean, there was some of that talk.
Well, that's not very, to me, that's really provincial. That's like small villages uniting against the outsiders. But that's a matter of tactics, Jen. I think it's not a good way to go, and I would strongly advocate against it.
Okay. And if you know the history of Oregon and racial minorities as outsiders, it can help to caution against and to think about your rhetoric, your unifying rhetoric.
Well, that's where one of the beauties of the First Amendment is, that it enables minorities to convert themselves into majorities. Otherwise, a majority could not be stopped from passing a law mm-hmm. banning all Republicans or banning, freezing themselves into position.
So we can acknowledge and support the right of the Proud Boys or Nazis to be present and to gather in our city, but we also have the right to shout them down.
Absolutely.
And oppose them.
Absolutely.
But that there is also the movement toward nonviolent civil disobedience partly is a moral and ethical position for many people, but it's also one that acknowledges that your rights stop once you start hitting people or engaging right. in violence in terms of rights guaranteed under the First Amendment. That doesn't mean that violence isn't a tactic that shouldn't be considered at some point, but it isn't protected, you're saying, by the...
Not by the First Amendment.
Yeah. Well, can we talk... Go ahead. You want to say more about that?
I want to say that a critical part of the First Amendment is protecting insular minorities. There's never going to be more African Americans than white people or brown people in the state of Oregon, for example. But Oregon cannot pass a law limiting or infringing upon their rights in any way. So you not only allow minorities to convert themselves into a majority, but groups of people who will never be more than 50% are permanently protected in their rights of expression by the First Amendment.
So this also extends in a, there's a gray area around civil disobedience or the right to petition the government. We, in our last minute or so, would you want to say anything about First Amendment rights and direct actions that involve the risk of arrest, how they're carried out, perhaps the necessity of these actions in light of other, the failure on the part of the state? I mean, we can't go into the whole basis of the necessity of defense as a legal strategy, but can you say anything in closing about civil disobedience?
Well, it's a critical way of raising issues that simply cannot be resolved by op-ed columns and discussions. And the necessity defense is primarily a defense. That is, it's guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment to subpoena witnesses, to cross-examine people and present a complete defense. But the First Amendment is involved, like the big demonstration against financiers in Broadway and Wall Street. And 4 years ago, people were not allowed to present a necessity defense, but the court acquitted everybody who was arrested on grounds that the police officer's orders for the protesters to disperse was overbroad. So the First Amendment is something that you're always, it allows you to get on the edge, and particularly when there's a dire urgency, it allows you to come as close as you can in your expressions to working for the changes that you feel are needed.
Okay, this is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker today talking about the First Amendment, knowing your legal rights, and actions on the streets.
Well, let me tell you about the climate dance. It's easy to do. You're nervous and you jump because this world's nearly through. So down some more tea, watch some foreign TV. Put your mind on anything but the truth. The leader's got a climate dance, it's easy to do. You grab hold of the treaty, then you tear it in two. Then go back to your people and spin me all about how the earth ain't gonna come to no harm. Gotta cut our emissions by 95%. You can fritter your money, but I tell you we're already spent.
That was Keshko with some somewhat ironic advice about the climate. And before that, The Left and the Law with more serious reflections on responding to the crisis. I'm Fran Michel. I've been your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Thanks to Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker for their discussion of First Amendment issues for activists. Thanks to Joe Clement and his guest, Marianne Garneau. And remember, there'll be more of their conversation posted to the Old Mole page at kboo.fm. Thanks to Bill Resnick and his guest, Emma Lyerly. Thanks to John Nielsen for editing help and to Patricia Kullberg for engineering. The Old Mole will be back next week with more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's grassroots perspective. Happy Labor Day, and stay tuned to KBOO. Don't forget, you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. Want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming? Download our mobile app today. Thanks for listening.